Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
As you may know, a lot of media companies are struggling right now, and Slate is no exception. So more than ever, we'd appreciate your direct support for all of Slate's entertaining content and important journalism. You can support that by signing up for Slate Plus. You can support the work that we do by signing up for Slate Plus. It's just $35 for your first year. You'll get ad-free podcasts and access to exclusive shows like Dana Stevens' classic movies podcast, Flashback. Slate Plus members won't hit a paywall on the site, so you can also enjoy all of Slate's journalism without worrying if you've reached your article limit. So if you'd like to support Slate, go to slate.com/plus and join Slate Plus today.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
I want to tell you my secret now. I see dead people.
Silent Green is people!
No, I am the father.
Rosebud. What's in the box?
You maniac! You blew it up! Damn you all to hell!
Hello, and welcome to this week's episode of Slate Spoiler Specials. I'm Sam Adams, a senior editor at Slate, and this week I'm joined by Browbeat editor Matthew Dessen. Matthew, hello.
Hello.
And podcast producer Daniel Schrader. Daniel.
Hey, Sam.
Today we are spoiling Ryan Murphy and Ian Brennan's Netflix series Hollywood. It's the story, based in fact, and then extremely not, of a group of up-and-coming filmmakers in 1940s Hollywood, a diverse and energetic group who set out to change the industry and the world, and eventually succeed. It's a history that becomes fantasy because, as one character puts it, movies don't just show us the world as it is. They show us the world as it can be. So we're going to get into discussing the series in its entirety, although because it's 7 hours long, we're obviously not going to go through the entire plot. But because this is a spoiler special, fair warning, we are going to be talking about the ending quite extensively. But before we do that, let's just give our general impressions. We'll start with you, Matthew Dessen. You know, what did you think of Hollywood? Would you recommend it? Not? What's your takeaway from it?
I couldn't entirely recommend it, no. it's like an interesting attempt to sort of recreate that world, and a lot of the details are very well done, but the writing, the plot, it just sort of at a certain point turns into fantasy in a way that I didn't really like.
Daniel, what about you?
It was not for me, and I would never recommend it to anybody because at times I think it is utterly unwatchable. But as with most Ryan Murphy shows, as a gay man, I feel some sort of like masochistic obligation to watch, even though at times it feels like I'm watching a Thomas Kinkade painting. But it was fun for the gifts and for a few of the actors.
Yeah. If anyone listening has read what either Matthew or I have written on Slate, this will be no surprise. It was also not something that I would recommend. It's kind of an interesting project that I think has some huge conceptual flaws in it. I like particularly a lot of the older actors in it. Holland Taylor and Joe Mantello and Patti LuPone especially kind of play the old guard of this fictional studio called Ace Pictures in 1947 Hollywood, and I really like the kind of energy and the gravitas they bring to it. The younger cast, for the most part, most of whom are supposed to be like bona fide movie stars, I think are really sort of, you know, of course it's a Ryan Murphy show, so they're all fantastically good looking, but I feel like in a really kind of bland and uninteresting way, so that they're just not particularly kind of compelling or interesting to watch. That in turn makes the rest of the story like much harder to get into. So let us talk about that story a little bit. It's a big kind of ensemble drama, so it's slightly hard to summarize, but I think the easiest place to start is with, if not the central character, the one who kind of drives the plot, is a, just getting started, a Hollywood director named Raymond Ainslie, played by Darren Criss, Ryan Murphy's old Glee compadre. He is, like Darren Criss himself, half Filipino director who has, you know, largely been passing for white in the industry, but does not want to, and has decided he kind of wants to make his mark on Hollywood by diversifying the industry. So his first idea is to stage a comeback vehicle for Anna Mae Wong, who is essentially the first Asian American movie star but her career was, you know, grossly curtailed by racism. So he wants to bring this movie that's going to kind of bring her back. He brings this idea to the studio. The studio is just like, are you kidding me? Like, of course we're not making a movie with a Chinese actress in the lead. So the second thing he comes up with is a movie called Peg, which is the story of Peg Entwistle, who's an aspiring actress who kind of famously killed herself by throwing herself off a Hollywood sign, jumping to her death. And so Hollywood becomes a story of them making this movie that's first called Peg, and later then when Raymond decides to cast his African-American girlfriend, Camille, played by Laura Harrier, in the role Meg. And so they're making a story about kind of Hollywood failure and how this town kind of eats people alive. But once they cast a black actress in the lead, they realize that they kind of can't tell that story because it sends the wrong message. And that's when it becomes an entirely different type of show. I think the easiest way to talk about it is kind of talk about like kind of the front half of the series, which is sort of straightforward-esque Hollywood history, albeit with a kind of, you know, revisionist slant. And then this kind of second half of the series from maybe like, you know, 5, 6, 7, the last few episodes, where it really kind of takes a rightward turn. Matthew, you wrote a big piece for the site, essentially fact-checking the thing, and you know a lot about Hollywood history, so you wrote a lot kind of comparing to, you know, Hollywood's version of Hollywood history with what it actually was. You know, what do you make, you know, particularly this kind of first half of the series, where it's, they're invented characters, an invented movie studio, but it is at least, you know, showing you some kind of real things about that world of Hollywood in 1947.
Yeah, I mean, at the beginning, it looks like it's going to be sort of a tour of Hollywood in the late 1940s. That seems to be the show's project. It starts with this Ace Studios thing, which is very clearly Paramount. All the pictures that they mention are Paramount. I mean, one of the things that's strangest about the show is that it didn't feel to me like it was building towards this moment where it took a twist off into fantasy. Like, it felt like there were a few episodes where they were trying to do a kind of a soapy drama about Hollywood in the 1940s, and then at a certain point they were like, it just goes into this different thing. That early stuff, I mean, it all has the same sort of problems for me as far as it being just incredibly over the top, and everyone says exactly what they're thinking and doing and why. You know, there's no subtext in it. Like, it's not interesting, but it's not crazy. And the sort of recreation of Hollywood in that era, although it's really pretty surface level, there are some details that are nice. One of the characters works at Schwab's drugstore, and the interior there is just gorgeous. Perfect. Lovely. So if you want to see an interior of Schwab's, that's your show. If you want to see human beings interacting like human beings, maybe not.
What are you doing watching a Ryan Murphy show?
Exactly. That's not the project.
Like, when we're told to believe that the actress who eventually becomes Meg is, like, the most amazing actress, it's something really difficult to stomach. It's like when we had to pretend that the Studio 60 sketches were funny.
Yeah. Well, Daniel, let me ask you, because you are kind of our, at least for the purposes of this podcast, you are our resident Ryan Murphy expert. The first half of the show kind of fits into this ongoing project he's had with Feud, with People versus OJ, of, you know, revisionist history in, I say that not in the kind of judgmental sense, but just as a, you know, legitimate historical endeavor. Fosse Verdon, obviously, is another example of this, where you take kind of established history and you either retell it from a different point of view, or you just kind of shift the emphasis in the character. So you have like another Marcia Clark episode of the OJ series, which takes this, you know, figure who was really largely vilified at the time and paints her in a very compelling way as a victim of systemic sexism. The Fosse Verdon show, which really basically tries to put, you know, Gwen Verdon on equal footing with her kind of acknowledged master, her, you know, ex-husband, Bob Fosse. So I don't know if you knew where this series was going as you were watching it, but did that feel kind of like it was moving along expected lines for you?
Yeah, I think that Ryan Murphy's beats are pretty familiar to me at this point, regardless of show. What this reminded me most of was Feud. And I think my question while watching this was, how much of a failure was Feud that Ryan Murphy thought, you know what, I think I need to make up stuff this time. So he just like pivoted from historical fact to like actually making up whole swaths of plot in ways that I thought were pretty unsuccessful because they felt so surface. There wasn't much depth to anything at all. One of the biggest problems I had with this whole show was that everybody knew everyone and was interconnected in like three different ways. The screenwriter that Darren Criss's character found the screenplay of is actually a prostitute at the gas station with another guy who becomes an actor. And then Rock Hudson, who's a character that we should talk about, like, appears as well. And it's all of these, like, hyper interconnected things that make it seem like there's no there besides what we see on screen. Like, and of course we can get into the stuff at the end, but when you start to get into the lead white guy Jack Costello's backstory, you realize there's nothing actually there. There's no, like, meat to it. And so I think this was an entirely meatless show that really wanted to feel good about itself as opposed to create interesting drama.
Right. I mean, one of the things that is, and I'm nowhere near like a Ryan Murphy completist, but I've seen, you know, a number of the series and kind of checked in on some of the other ones. And one of the things that I really, you know, make an effort to kind of give him credit for is I think he's just a great, in general, like a kind of a great talent scout. I mean, for me, if Ryan Murphy had done nothing more than make Sarah Paulson the star that she always should have been, like Dainu, there are a lot of, you know, relatively new figures in this, particularly among the young cast. You have some, you know, more established figures and some of the older actors. But so you have David Corn Sweat, who's also in Ryan Murphy's The Politician, his first Netflix series, playing this aspiring actor, Jack Costello, Jake Picking playing Rock Hudson, Samara Weaving playing Claire Wood, who is another aspiring actress and also the daughter of the head of Ace Studios. I mentioned Laura Harrier, probably best known, I guess, as Liz from Spider-Man Homecoming, who's playing this, you know, big star and eventual best actress winner, Camille Washington. And then you have Jeremy Pope, who's playing Archie Coleman, who is this aspiring screenwriter, kind of young black screenwriter, who is very conscious of kind of not wanting to get pigeonholed in the world of what were then called race movies, which are kind of the black or Asian or whatever movies. And so he has written the script about Peg Entwistle, this, you know, white British actress killing herself to show that he has range, so to speak. It's a very tall order for the show because the plot requires them to cast multiple actors in roles where the character is seen by a person with, you know, decades of Hollywood experience, and that person immediately goes, they're a star. And it's really hard to find even one young person with that kind of instant charisma, let alone four or five of them. I mean, do you feel like they succeed? I mean, are these kind of young actors you want to see in other things, or how do we kind of evaluate that aspect of the show, I guess?
I mean, it's a structural problem when you have people that are supposed to be good at acting that you don't have if you have a character who is a good novelist or a good painter or whatever. You can hire somebody to do a painting, but that's always a problem with anything where a character is supposed to be very good at a skill that we can all see whether or not they're good at it.
Okay, maybe Laura Harrier is a better actress than I'm giving her credit for, but I did not care for her in this role. And it was really tragic to see, like, Samara Weaving, who I think is a good actress, kind of halfway through her screen test be like, fuck it, I don't care about this, and then kind of pass it off to actually the worst actress, yeah. Even though, like, for the plot, she is the better actress. And I kept wondering, like, as people kept screening this movie, who is being moved by this performance? I think that Ryan Murphy is good at collecting a bunch of pretty people that we will forget about in a few years, every few years.
The one thing that I would say about it for sure, though, is that there's only so much you can do with the dialogue. The dialogue on the show is just sort of unbelievable. It is everybody saying exactly, this is what I am thinking and why. And then you have this imagined Peg or Meg movie that you have dialogue for that. And that's, you know, on the nose in a 1940s way, but no less than the other stuff. It's just, these aren't, what can you do with it? You know, there's only so much you can do if that's your script.
The most absurd line of dialogue in the entire show for me, and it was my favorite gift that I sent to all of my friends, was when the screenwriter looks in a mirror at a bar and says, I won't be a black writer writing about some white lady. I'll just be a writer. And it was so, like, subtext as text, no attempt to, like, add nuance to this. It was just, this is what I'm writing, in a way that felt like Ryan Murphy was talking to himself in that moment, yeah. Of this is what I'm saying about myself as an artist. And that never worked.
Yeah, it didn't seem like anybody understood themselves or their industry in the way that somebody might have in 1947. Like, the perspective was absolutely 2020. People talked about these issues in the way they do in 2020. It didn't feel like that time period at all.
I kept thinking that if a actor from the 1940s saw this, they would jump off the Hollywood sign after having seen it.
Yeah, I mean, there is, and we're going to, you know, we're going to talk about kind of the twist that the series takes later on, where it becomes kind of, you know, extremely, like, aggressively presentist. But there are all these really kind of clangy moments where people in the 1940s say at one point, when they're discussing whether or not they're going to try and release what they cast as the first studio movie with an African-American lead, and they say, well, we want to change the conversation. There's a point where they're having a story meeting, and this Joe Mantello, kind of like the, you know, head of development for the studio, says, oh, well, that's kind of a trope, isn't it? And there's one scene, this is my favorite slash thing that makes me want to, like, claw my ears out. There's a point where an editor whose career goes back to the silent era uses the word creatives. I don't feel like anyone should be using that word in the year 2020, let alone 1947. You can make an argument, and I try to kind of give them the benefit of the doubt, that this is, you know, they're showing kind of deliberately nodding to the way that it's departing from history, but it grates on my ear in a certain way. I mean, I didn't want to single out kind of among the young cast. I mean, Daniel, you mentioned Samara Weaving, who I think is established enough that you can't really kind of call a discovery at this point. She's had a, you know, starring role in a kind of, you know, what's already a cult movie called Ready or Not a couple of years ago. She is great at it. And I think Jeremy Pope, who plays Archie Coleman, the screenwriter, basically his kind of first screen thing that he's done, was in one movie from a couple years ago that I've never even heard of before. So he is, I feel like, a bona fide discovery. He has kind of, I feel, kind of like real presence and magnetism. Like, he's someone I would want to see in something else again. Of course, he's not playing an actor.
they cast him as in the one role where he can't use those acting things to make the rest of it more credible.
You mentioned in the series that really kind of seems to be, in a way, kind of Ryan Murphy and I guess Ian Brennan kind of talking to themselves about how important, like, you know, the creatives and the, you know, the writers and directors are. So the fact that, like, they cast, you know, some of the most magnetic, interesting actors as the writer and director in the story is, if not intentional, at least maybe something they could talk to their therapists about. One of the ways that this story is kind of aggressively revisionist, really kind of, you know, revealing something that would not have been common knowledge at the time, is a subplot that starts with Jack Castello, this aspiring actor, finding work at a gas station run by Dylan McDermott, who is this sort of former actor who has basically become a pimp in his middle age. This gas station does in fact pump gas, but more importantly, it is a front for a large-scale prostitution ring. Basically, I think if not exclusively male prostitutes, most of the ones we see are male, and they service both men and women. So that kind of introduces this whole very persistent subplot of this kind of sexual undercurrent of Hollywood in 1947, just being much more complicated than the sort of, certainly than the image of the town that Hollywood would have presented itself at the time. So you have, as you mentioned, Rock Hudson, who is then kind of an aspiring actor, was obviously gay, although in real life was closeted almost until his death in 1985. It wasn't until he had to go public with having HIV that his homosexuality kind of became public, although is, you know, an open secret probably for decades. Archie Coleman, the screenwriter, becomes his sort of long-term boyfriend. This character played by Jim Parsons, called Henry Wilson, who's based on a real figure, who becomes Rock Hudson's agent and requires Rock, as he does most of his male clients, to sleep with him in order to advance his career. So it's this whole kind of thing that runs through the series.
And if I can say, it's that plotline that made me sort of do a double take when it went off the rails, off the timeline, because for the most part, that's based on two, you know, real memoirs, which are Scottie Bowers, who was a gas station attendant turned pimp, turned prostitute or whatever, but was responsible for making those kind of assignations out of a gas station in Hollywood. He wrote a memoir about it. And his portrait of that time period in Hollywood is kind of revisionist history that you would read and think, hey, this could make a great Ryan Murphy show. And the way that the show begins, it's like, okay, that's it. It's going to sort of follow this line. The point of the show is going to be, wow, there was a lot of crazy stuff going on back then that people don't know about. And the same thing is true with Henry Wilson and Rock Hudson's thing. That was, Wilson was a real guy. He really was Rock's agent. He was responsible for all of those kind of 50s beefcake actors, Tab Hunter, you know, whatever. He gave those people his names and was not a very good guy. And so I thought, okay, that's the show. But then it turns out that's not the project at all, really. That's just the jumping off point.
I mean, you saying it now, that sounds like such a better show. And honestly, that's the problem with, I think, my like overarching theory of Ryan Murphy shows is that they're great to start, but then they fall apart once he gets an idea about what he's making. If he just hit start and then walked away and let other people keep making it, it would be a lot better, I think. The Jim Parsons role was, I think, my favorite part of the show, just in terms of his pure, absurd commitment to the role. He's like, fuck it, I have Big Bang money now. I can do whatever I want. And so he's just like dancing around with like scarves and being really bitchy and an awful person. Like, he is a Machiavellian gay, but in a way that like I loved and really enjoyed getting to watch, like when he has the monologue about his like lover who died at 19 and then immediately pivots into like, okay, Rock, now we're going to have sex again with these two guys. It was really like, it was gross, but it was fun in like a, this is the type of like lurid Hollywood stuff I wanted to watch when I was watching this, as opposed to what shakes out at near the end, which we need to get into, and I think also speaks to maybe some of the things Ryan Murphy might be trying to work out himself.
One of my kind of issues with the show is that, you know, Henry Wilson is one of the people, Anna Mae Wong, Rock Hudson, I mean a number of, Hattie McDaniel, who appears briefly in the stories later on, played by Queen Latifah. I mean, these are all people with like amazing lives and amazing stories, and they really, by and large, you know, have not been told, certainly in kind of, you know, fictional, like, biopic form. The idea of just sort of, like, making up these, like, young, attractive people who are just go-getters and, like, change the system because they really wanted to do it real bad. It's just, like, why not tell, like, the real stories that are interesting and largely untold? I mean, there's never been an Anna Mae Wong movie. There's never been a Hattie McDaniel movie. Like, why not make that instead?
The thing about Jim Parsons' performance, I would say, is that he seemed to be the one person who sort of knew how the show could work, you know, like he knows what kind of show he's on and how to, like, it gets just very earnest in ways that don't work later on. The more it gets into, didn't work for me anyway.
We'll move into the kind of the second half of the story now. I think the pivotal point for this, kind of the inciting incident for the second half, is a visit to Ace Studios by Eleanor Roosevelt.
Real quick, this is my favorite moment. So they're trying to decide whether or not they should release Meg because it's starring a black woman. And Patti LuPone, who is currently the head of the studio because her husband, played by Rob Reiner, is currently in a coma. And so she is talking to Eleanor Roosevelt at lunch and saying, oh, I feel so awful because we should give it to this one actress, but she's black and she's the better actress, but we should give it, like, we're going to give it to the white girl. And there's just this zoom in on Eleanor Roosevelt's face in that moment that is just literally the moment that these white women discovered intersectional feminism.
Eleanor Roosevelt says to her, and I'm going to read this quote because it's truly astonishing. Eleanor Roosevelt, and this is in 1947, 2 years after the end of World War II, says, I used to believe that good government could change the world. I don't know that I believe that anymore. However, what you do, you fantastic Hollywood people, what you do can change the world. That is just the most, like, mind-blowingly self-serving thing for a Hollywood production, that's literally called Hollywood, to say essentially about itself. Like, you know what really matters is us. You talked about making the subtext text, Daniel, and this is the show just coming right out and saying it. Like, what we do is really important. This is a show about how important we are. So it is, I guess, give them credit for owning up to it, but it is just, you kind of have to pick your jaw up after the floor, after that.
Yeah, it was just an astonishing moment. In a show full of astonishing moments.
Well, so this is where the turn happens, as you were saying, where like the astonishing moments start coming one after another. And it turns out that it's just like the social justice warrior brigade of 1947 out to save the film industry. Rob Reiner wakes up and he's like, wait, we can't do this movie, after like some of the characters had gotten burning crosses placed in their yards, even though no actual like violence or anything fell upon them. This was just like something for the show to kind of signpost for us that like this is happening for them, so they didn't have to like get into any of that. Rob Reiner wakes up, he's like, no, we can't do this anymore, tries to cancel everything. They end up like wanting to burn the movie, as opposed to putting it out so as not to lose all of the money that they are possibly losing on all of the other movies that were in production or were airing but are now pulled because of this race picture that they're trying to make. And so everything goes in the fire, and then Rob Reiner is having dinner with Patti LuPone at their house, and they kind of have a discussion where Patty's like, you know what? I'm done taking this anymore. I had a taste of power and I'm not going back to not having it anymore. So make me a partner. And he just says, well, okay. And agrees to. And then we're like, oh, wow, Rob Reiner is a good guy. He's like going to be a savior along with everybody else. This is great. And then he dies that night in his sleep. And so it's like he gets this savior moment and then he gets to die, and then they still burn the movie.
And we still
and
have to watch the show.
Yeah, we still, exactly, like Rob Reiner got out of it.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to, has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here, we were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
I mean, there's this consistent theme in the second half of the show. And Matthew, in your piece, you kind of detailed like all the milestones that end up happening in the story. And then when they actually happened in real life, you know, when was the first like interracial kiss in a Hollywood movie? When was the first, you know, woman of color to win Best Actress? I think the most staggering of them is the first Black person to win Best Original Screenplay, which is a milestone that happened in the long distant past of 2018, when Jordan Peele won for Get Out. That happened in 1947 in this movie, you know, a mere, you know, 65 years ahead of schedule. But as you're saying, Daniel, I mean, it's this consistent thing in the story where these barriers fall in this story, not because, you know, kind of people sacrifice and bleed and build up structures that can change the way the world works, but just because they kind of ask a lot. They put their foot down. You know, Patti LuPone says, I really want to be, you know, the head of the studio with you. And Rob Reiner says, good point. That's fair. Okay. Darren Criss says, look, I'm not making this movie with a white lead. I'm only going to make it if we change the title and my Black girlfriend plays the lead. And the studio goes, okay, sure, you're right. That just kind of happens again and again. And there is, you know, a wish fulfillment aspect to it that I think is kind of not to be dismissed. I mean, I've been thinking about this for weeks, and then our former Slate colleague, Aisha Harris, wrote something about it in the New York Times this week, and I'll just quote this. There is something to be said for the show's fluffy confection of ahistoricism when it's not indulging in myths of racial reconciliation in movies as changemakers. The happy resolutions conjured up by message films from the Hollywood era almost always benefited straight white people and no one else. Here is a fantasy set in the past where women, people of color, and queer characters ultimately win too. A part of me can't ignore what it feels like to see this technicolor spectacle populated by these faces and experiences, to see the 1940s depicted through a 2020 lens, browner, less sexually repressed, more women calling the shots. You know, I think that that is definitely powerful, and I think that is clearly what Ryan Murphy and Ian Brennan and all the other people who made this show, that's their vision. Obviously, this isn't what happened, but like, what if it had? I think I saw someone describe it on Twitter as like a what if story where the premise is like, what if people were fundamentally decent? you know, which is like, great. I mean, we wouldn't live to live in that world, you know, that it's more like kind of just and equitable. And if people point out that your industry is kind of, you know, structurally racist and sexist and homophobic, you go, oh, yeah, I guess it is. You put out this movie that's like the first, you know, Hollywood movie with an interracial romance and a Black female lead, and you put it in front of audiences, and they go to it, and they go, you know what? I love that. I'm going to tell my friends to go see it. And then they go see it, and then it's a big box office hit, and then it wins Best Picture and everything else. And it's like, it feels like in this movie, like, people want to be good, and they just need an excuse to do it. One of the kind of more minor historical things in it, but it's significant, is there's this whole the whole reason why the studio says they kind of can't make Meg in the first place instead of Peg is because Southern movie theaters are not going to play a movie theater with a mixed race cast because they're going to boycott it. That's just way too much of their business. The studio can't risk it. Not only are they not going to play Meg, but they will pull all of A Studio's other movies if they even try to release it. That's why they end up wanting to burn the negative. So Dick Samuels, who's this studio executive played by Joe Mantello, to counter this, he invents what he decides to call the wide release, which is a studio technique that was not actually implemented until 1975 and kind of really caught on with Jaws in 76.
Not a vector for social change, the release.
No, not then, not ever. But the idea is if you just kind of flood the zone, if you like change the conversation and put this thing, I think they say in like 650 theaters or something, that's an unimaginable number, 1947, people will feel like they have to go see it. There's these newsreel clips of like, you know, sort of white women coming out of this theater and being like, I really identified with the character. I felt like she was me. I felt like she was going through what I was going through. It's just like people just want to see this. And it's this very nice, but again, also very, you know, self-serving thing where like mass entertainment is kind of the cure-all for things. And that this is going on Netflix as well, which is kind of made this like part of its brand. Just like really just feels very like, kind of, you know, throwing out your shoulder to pat yourself on the back.
Well, and it's so divorced from like the idea of white supremacy as a kind of material system that people benefit from, you know? I mean, the thing about it that is strange to me is it's not beyond the realm of possibility that one studio could have made one film with one interracial kiss in 1947, but it's the idea that that film would then convince all of America to stop being racist and which is what, I mean, there's something in there about how when the movie first comes out, there are protests and then the protests, a newsreel guy cheerfully says that protests just melted away when the movie was released. And it's like,
yeah, the line in the newsreel is verbatim, racial protests of every kind simply melted away as audiences rushed out to see a new kind of motion picture. That didn't happen in like, you know, a couple years ago when Black Panther came out. Like it just doesn't work that way.
I like the idea of that this gives a meaningful look into like what if Hollywood were different, and what if things were nicer and happier for people of color and queer people. But as a gay man, my problem with that is that there's no substance to this. There's no meaning behind it. And so any of this storytelling for marginalized groups doesn't have any weight for me if it doesn't have any like sense of depth for itself. It's really tough to have watched this ever after getting to watch Watchmen. Uncomparable projects, but at the same time, like we have Damon Lindelof making an amazing analysis of race in America, and then we have Ryan Murphy making Hollywood.
I think, Sam, you wrote about this too, but it's one of those things where it's like, if it was that simple, why didn't someone do this in 1947? You know, it just makes it seem like there was nothing on the other side there. That entire institution is just a paper tiger.
Right. There's a moment in the story where Camille Washington, who's the actress, goes to visit Hattie McDaniel, who is in real life the first person of color to win an acting Oscar. And Hattie McDaniel says, well, you know, tells her this whole story, which is not entirely true, but the idea is basically sound, saying, well, you know, when I was nominated for an Oscar, you know, the hotel was segregated and they wouldn't let me in the door. You know, security like turned me away. You know, it was only when the word kind of got out that I had actually won that they like snuck me in the back right beforehand so I could go up and accept it. Patty says to Camille, okay, if that happened, like, don't make the mistake I made. Basically, like, it happens to you, like, don't let them do that. And so sure enough, Camille is nominated for an Oscar. She goes to the ceremony. The security at the door tries to turn her away. And she just goes, no, like, if you don't let me in, I'll scream. And they kind of look uncomfortable. And then they kind of go sheepishly, like, oh, okay, I'll just let you in. And it's basically this like fantasy. Like, what if these people were decent and knew, and what if those security guards knew on some level that they were doing the wrong thing? And they just had to be called out on it. And they would kind of give in to that sense of shame. But it inadvertently also conveys this idea that, like, well, why didn't Hattie McDaniel do that? Like, I guess it's her fault for not like standing up for herself. And it just is no, I feel like there's no understanding of like, you know, Hattie McDaniel went through like shit that like none of us can imagine. now. She just, like, you know, broke down these barriers, like, you know, went through these, like, trials, just, like, you know, sweated blood, gave so much to, you know, to play these roles that in now a lot of them look like pretty horrific. These kind of, you know, comic, you know, domestics in, you know, movies in the 30s and 40s. And the, some of the stuff is, like, painful to watch, but it was, like, it was, that stuff was really, like, hard fought and difficult to achieve. And to sort of insinuate, even by accident, that she, if she had, like, just tried a little harder, she could have done better, is just, that makes me insane.
It's kind of interesting if you look at the way that she tells that story and what actually happened with Hattie McDaniels, because it does sort of stand in for the way that Murphy's kind of changed the way this stuff seems to actually have worked. Because what really happened with Hattie McDaniels at that Academy Award ceremony is the Ambassador Hotel was segregated, but there was no one at the door who was like, oh no, Hattie McDaniels is, I mean, they knew Hattie McDaniels was nominated for this thing. Selznick arranged with the hotel for her to be allowed into the ballroom. That was all set up in advance. She was given a separate table away from her white co-stars or whatever. There was a compromise, but all of that was done, that was out of Hattie McDaniels' hand. And there was no moment where they were like, oh, she won, she has to come in because she's just so good at acting. Like, this movie in Hollywood is just so good that it erases racism. It was all stage managed event. That was never a possibility, because it was all been arranged, you know, well in advance.
This is Hollywood. I mean, they know the optics.
Yeah, there isn't the moment where the one person can say, yes, now this changes, and it just does. I mean, that system had been arranged to make sure that Hattie McDaniels was not presented with that moment.
So I want to circle back. Like, we mentioned Rock Hudson a little bit before, and I feel like he is one of the truly, you know, kind of fascinating and complex characters in this story, albeit I don't feel like he entirely gets his due in this, but he's such, like, an interesting figure. There's a great sort of, you know, seminal work of new queer cinema called Rock Hudson's Home Movies by Mark Rappaport that's on Amazon Prime now, possibly among other places, and that sort of has it's kind of a textual reading of these clips from all these, you know, like Doris Day and Douglas Sirk movies that Rock Hudson made, with an actor playing Rock Hudson kind of narrating over them. If you want to kind of have your mind blown for like 15 minutes, I suggest going and looking through the reviews of that on Amazon Prime, because it has like a 1.5-star rating. Like 70% of the reviews are people like, these are not Rock Hudson home movies. How dare you? And then there's one person who called it homophobic. And then there was another person who said, like, well, look, Rod Hudson may well have been gay. But, and I'm just like, why? I feel like this is settled law at this point. He is one of those characters who I think, is genuinely, you know, like, troublesome to a modern sensibility, because he had his entire career as a closeted man. And I feel like it's really difficult to wrestle with that in 2020 and to kind of make excuses for that. But I mean, what do we make of, like, how he's portrayed in this?
I mean, when he first showed up at Dreamland, which is the gas station, I didn't know who the character was going to be. I was like, oh, this is some idiot from Iowa. I texted Ingu, actually, and said, is this Pete Buttigieg? and then of course it turned out to be Rock Hudson, and so I got a laugh at that. But his whole story through this has been interesting, because it is kind of like the closeted gay man from the country coming in to the big city, figuring out, like, what form of, like, sexuality is safe for him and not. And he ends up with Henry Wilson, who sexually abuses him for a number of years during their professional relationship. That happened in real life, and we see that play out at times, like at George Cukor's party. George Cukor's a real person. Matt, you wrote about him in your piece going through the fact and fiction of this show, so if anyone wants to know about that, check there. In the show, that's the moment where, like, Rock Hudson realizes, I want to have a boyfriend. And so he, like, puts down his claim on his boyfriend, Archie, who's the screenwriter. And it's just a very weird depiction of closeted homosexuality, at least from my understanding of it at that time. Because, yeah, there were, like, these types of parties that happened. I think there are still, like, modern versions of this. But the whole story of Rock Hudson as this, like, heartthrob who is closeted and is sexually abused really ends on one of the most disappointing notes, I think, of the whole series for me. As we unpack the ending, I think we should touch on him because of how his and Jim Parsons' character, Henry Wilson's, like, relationship kind of plays out in the end in ways that made me really uncomfortable.
Ryan Murphy said one of his motivations for this was, I wanted to give, you know, happy endings to people who didn't have them. So Anna May Wong died on the eve of what could have been her comeback vehicle. She gets to be in Meg and she wins a Best Supporting Actress Oscar. But, you know, Rock Hudson's happy ending is that, like, his boyfriend thanks him from the stage at the Oscars. And then it's kind of, like, left out, well, because he's not a movie star in 1947. And it's like, does that happen at all? Because he's still, like, just a terrible actor who, and this is based on fact, I mean, you know, can't get through a one-line appearance without needing, like, 48 takes. But that seems like a very weird, like, his happy ending is he has a boyfriend.
Yeah, I gotta say, my big question about this whole series is, do I need to watch a Rock Hudson movie?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
I mean, not because of the series, but yeah, for sure.
Okay.
Yeah, watch Magnificent Obsession, or, yeah, he's great. He's an actor who can be very well used, I guess I would say. He's not, I don't think anybody's going to say he's a great actor, but there are some things he did very, very well.
Yeah, I think that's probably something you would say about a lot of the actors of that time is they were of use.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, I will check
those
out.
Acting showcases or no, they're definitely worth checking.
And Matthew, like, as our kind of, you know, Hollywood historian expert on this, like, what do you think of, I mean, Rock Hudson specifically, but, you know, sort of the way any of the other historical figures are portrayed in this?
I mean, I think that they deal with repression and social pressure and all of that stuff all in much more interesting ways than Hollywood did. You know, like, it's very interesting to me. I really do enjoy seeing people wrestling with that kind of, like, what they can do in the system in which they're living. I find that to be very fascinating. There's a way in which this could have been that, but it really wasn't.
Maybe this is just intentional and, you know, snake swallowing its own tail-ish, but there is something so very non-italic Hollywood about italic Hollywood's way of resolving these questions. I mean, it's just like, it all comes down to, like, individuals making choices and, like, taking a stand and standing up for themselves. And that's just, like, the very rarely, like, how real change happens. Like, we love to, you know, enshrine the story of, like, Rosa Parks sitting down on the bus, but we don't like to say, like, that Rosa Parks was, like, an activist who was part of an organization who knew exactly what she was doing that was deliberately provoking this boycott. She wasn't just, like, a woman who made a decision one day. But we don't like the story of, like, organized social change, because that sort of goes against our whole idea of American individualism or something.
Part of it is that, like, as long as you believe that all you have to do to throw over these systems is have one person sit down on the bus or one person make one movie or whatever, then to the extent the system still exists, it's just, well, you know, if they wanted this to change, they would have changed it by now.
Yeah, I'm just tired of Ryan Murphy's savior complex. One other thing before we, like, wrap up the whole story is the ending with Henry Wilson and Rock Hudson, which to me was kind of a betrayal of, like, the type of progressiveness that this show wants to nod toward, I feel, because Henry Wilson spent the whole show sexually abusing Rock Hudson. And then in the end, he's basically like, you know what? I'm sorry. I feel so bad that I did this to you. Can you forgive me? I'm messed up, blah, 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 blah. And Rock Hudson just forgives him and everything's fine. It feels like there's this lack of either understanding of the trauma that was caused or a lack of willingness to acknowledge that there was trauma in that experience. And this is not the series equipped to handle trauma like that, of course. I don't know if any Ryan Murphy series ever is, but when you create something like this that is so toxic, and to then just wash it away with, I'm sorry, oh, it's okay, really sat wrong with me.
So just to kind of bring our discussion of the plot to the close, there's the point Meg finally gets made. It's going to be this big, you know, groundbreaking, you know, history-making, taboo-shattering movie. You know, Avis Amberg, this Patti LuPone, the temporary studio head, has convinced her husband after he gets out of his coma to get behind it. Everything's going fine. He has a heart attack and dies. All of a sudden, you know, this is the all is lost moment. The new head of the studio, who are just complete money men, they decide that they need the Southern Theater owners back on their side. The best way they do that is to completely destroy Meg. They burn the only copy of the film. That's it. It's all over. That's all she wrote. But then it turns out that the editor from the silent era, who knows the word creatives, kept a dupe of the negative in his car trunk because he worked on The Wizard of Oz. And he remembered when they tried to burn that. I didn't want to let it happen to this movie. So hooray, the movie's back. Somehow they don't have the exact same problem releasing that copy of it that they would have the copy that they previously burned. So yes, they put the movie out. The market speaks. The market says, this is what we want. The Oscars say, well, if the market wants it, we want it too. Everybody wins Oscars. Hooray. Racism is over. The end.
Well, the end, except that then we find out a year later that they start production on Love, Simon.
You were asking earlier what would become of Rock Hudson in this timeline, and that seems to be it. At the end, they begin like a movie about the service station, and so apparently...
Yeah, it becomes a movie about Hollywood, yeah. The series we just watched.
One of the extraordinary things, that yeah, we should mention this, is it jumps over to a year. We find out that Dick Samuels, the character played by Joe Mantello, has died, and we find out that Dylan McDermott's character, the pimp, who's been, you know, sort of setting it up for closeted Hollywood actors and directors to have, you know, secret tryst with male prostitutes, is shutting down his business because since one screener editor got up on stage and thanked his boyfriend at the Oscars, gay men are no longer ashamed of their sexuality, and that being the only reason they would ever go visit sex workers, his business is bottomed out and he is just getting out of it. That's sort of the cherry on the sundae there. I mean, the idea that like shame is over because one thing happened at the Oscars. And then it, instead of the end, it actually says, like, the beginning? Question mark?
Well, shame is over, and literally every single person gets a happy ending, even the dead people. Like, Dylan McDermott ends up with Holland Taylor, which that is a great straight version of the Holland Taylor-Sarah Paulson relationship. Samara Weaving ends up with David Corin Sweat, who plays Jack Costello, who earlier in the series had a wife and got her pregnant, but it turns out that she was pregnant with this other guy who she gets to be happy with, so they're off on their own. Even when Joe Mantello dies, like, he died with a man still loving him that he had met a few months before his death and got to live openly gay as well. So, like, every single person gets this tight little bow on their story that, like, there is no sadness in Hollywood. There's only happiness. Everything works out as it should. In the, like, to me, the most offensive way possible is someone who, like, knows any story about Hollywood ever. Like, I don't know. I kept wanting to see the BoJack Horseman treatment of this or something.
Oh, my God. I would love the BoJack treatment of this story so much.
Well, that ends the minute that the production code authority finds out that this movie's being made. It's a very short series.
Right.
Truly.
Because we've been pretty down on it kind of as a group. I mean, is there an aspect of this, like a, you know, a storyline, a performance or something that you actually do like or would recommend? Or should we just go watch Tiger King again?
You know, the thing that it reminded me of after it took its turn was something like Inglourious Basterds or whatever, you know, like I don't think there's something inherently wrong with being like, but what if it all went, you know, what if the slot machine came up sevens or whatever at this one point? What happens then? But it just didn't work. Everything was just so written in 2020 language. Everyone understood themselves in 2020 language. So no, I guess is my answer. No, there's nothing I'd really recommend about it. Except for, again, the Schwab's drugstore set, exquisite.
Yeah, I think for me, the only way that I could imagine recommending it is from a camp approach where you just pluck out things like Jim Parsons, Mira Sorvino, Paget Brewster as these just like random characters. Paget Brewster played Tallulah Bankhead at one point as just these like random performances, maybe untethered from the rest of the piece, but on their own are these like beautiful artifacts.
Some of those performances are so kind of bad and like badly cast that they do sort of have a certain like camp value. And then I do think like Holland Taylor and Patti LuPone and, you know, Joe Mantello are actually like really great, but there's not enough of them to really justify sitting through 7 hours of it. If this thing possibly drives people to watch you know, Rock Hudson movies or learn more about Hollywood in 1947, or certainly to kind of discover Anime Wong, that's fantastic.
I just worry that they'll stop here.
Exactly. If this is like the your introduction to a bunch of stuff you then look into, fantastic. But if this is your understanding of what Hollywood was like in the 1940s, no, it wasn't like
God
that.
Help us all.
I will just say to our listeners that if you are interested enough in this show to listen to us talk about it for almost an hour, please go in and watch Anime Wong movies. Piccadilly is streaming online now. Watch some, you know, Rock Hudson movies. Those are great and super enjoyable, and I think you'll get a lot out of them, and I hope that you do. Okay, that's our show. Please subscribe to the Slate Spoiler Special podcast feed, and if you like the show, please rate and review it in the Apple Podcast Store or wherever you got your podcasts. If you have suggestions for movies or TV shows we should spoil, or if you have any other feedback you'd like to share, please send it to spoilers@slate.com. Our producer is Rosemary Belson. For Matthew Dessen and Daniel Schrader, I'm Sam Adams. Thank you for listening.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.